Welcome to Media Path. I'm Louise Palenker.
And I'm Fritz Coleman.
If your Media Path does not include TikTok, it probably does include Little House on the Prairie, Heathers, JAG, and some of the 90-odd IMDb credits of one Patrick Laberteau, who is now a TikTok sensation with his captivating personal showbiz stories. Patrick is right here with us. He's about to join us. But first, Fritz, what are you recommending that we stop and visit along our media path?
Well, I have a book this week. It's called Horse.
Okay.
It's written by Geraldine Brooks. She won a Pulitzer Prize for this book. It's the true story of a horse that is considered the greatest racehorse of all time. His name is Lexington. I have no interest in racehorse things. I think it's cruel and expensive. But this story is about much more than a horse. The story starts in 1850 when a young enslaved boy is present at the foal where the foal is born and the foal grows up to become Lexington. With masterful storytelling, we go from the barn where the Lexington is birthed to a present-day scenario when a painting of the horse is retrieved from a wastebasket to a Smithsonian Institute side room where Lexington's bones were being preserved. To me, the pre-Civil War setting around 1850 is the most powerful aspect of this book. It's such a rich depiction of slavery. It's the relationship between the enslaved and their owners. It's surviving when you can't control your own destiny. A young horse groom named Jarrett gets his power by being the only one that has a relationship with this amazing horse. And Jarrett's a young slave, and he's the only human that Lexington responds to, and that gives Jarrett power over the racist thoroughbred trade and the even more racist Confederacy. Jarrett stays with Lexington through the whole Civil War. Incidentally, one of Lexington's progeny becomes Ulysses S. Grant's horse called Cincinnati. This is all very true. The amount of research Geraldine Brooks did to bring Lexington's legend to life is really impressive. And that Geraldine Brooks is Australian and was able to paint such a masterful portrait of one of the bleakest periods in American history is pretty amazing. She, the author, said, "Only horses were honest in the end."
Wow.
I love that. It's a really wonderful book. You will love it, even if you don't care about horse racing.
No, it sounds fascinating. It's really difficult to find a horse that kept a journal, so that can be so helpful in your storytelling. So I'm going to be recommending American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders on Netflix. In 1991, freelance writer and reporter Danny Casolaro was digging into a conspiracy theory that he had come to call the octopus when he was found dead in a West Virginia hotel. He had warned his brother just that week that if he turned up dead, it was not a suicide. Danny, just 100 miles from home, was immediately embalmed and his death ruled a suicide. His slide into the dark corners of international spies and mobsters begins with a look-see into a company called Inslaw, which had created a computer software program for the DOJ called Promise. This was a criminal investigation database at the very dawn of the computer age, so you can understand its value. Inslaw then alleged that just as Reagan came into office, the DOJ reneged and stiffed them for $2 million. As Danny worked through the case, he pulled at strings that were connected to ropes and pulleys and dangerous organisms. He posited that the Inslaw case, the Iran-Contra arms deal, the delayed release of the Iran hostages, the closure of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and maybe even Watergate, the Bay of Pigs, and the Kennedy assassination were all connected and orchestrated by a ring of rogue intelligence officers. A similar tale is told in the podcast from Rob Reiner and Soledad O'Brien called Who Killed JFK? But this four-part American Conspiracy docuseries on Netflix follows investigators Christian Hansen and Zachary Trites as they retrace Danny's steps and try to piece together what may have happened before his death. It's a wormhole. Pack a sandwich. Take breaks. Remember to blink. There is so much intrigue to unpack when it comes to shadowy underworld figures linked to world leaders entwined in global conspiracy theories, but the series reminds us that perspective is everything. Mysteries are addictive. We can't know everything. Remember to look up and out and at the world you inhabit and at the people who love you. American Conspiracy is on Netflix.
I liked it, but at the end I thought, you know what? Have I been hosed? The whole thing is very manipulative. All the personalities are addicted to being manipulative to other people.
Right.
So at the end you say, I don't know anything more than I did 2.5 hours ago.
Right, but it's the kind of thing where it like pulls you along going, maybe, and then at the very end, maybe not.
Right.
So, but, you know, it's about all these figures. And
no, but the Iran-Contra thing, God. And some of the other conspiracies that we've only scratched the surface with.
Well, it just makes you wonder if those hostages were kept for an additional year because the Reagan team or people loosely affiliated with the Reagan campaign sort of promised a certain amount of money.
Begged them not to release him until he took office.
Well, the timing of when they were released is definitely would cause one to ponder. And we're going to forever ponder these things and never know the truth about a lot of this stuff. So it's fun to think about, but you don't want to get sucked in. And we'll see how Patrick feels about this after I introduce him. Patrick Francis Laberteau is an American actor who has been on the job since the age of 3. He worked all the way through his childhood and into his adulthood, and he hasn't stopped. You know him from his role as Andy Garvey in Little House on the Prairie. He played Bud Roberts on JAG and also on NCIS. He runs Working Actors School, and he is most recently a TikTok sensation with an engaging and compelling delivery of his own real-life, behind-the-scenes showbiz stories. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, guys.
Now, I have to
really
ask you.
I'm fascinated by that conspiracy show.
Yeah, you got to see
the number one series on Netflix right now, Patrick. So you guys have to watch
it. Okay.
Yeah.
At the end of it, you'll say, and I can't get that time back.
But, no,
but it's fascinating because it does touch on things where facts are known, like the Iran-Contra.
Yeah,
thing.
It does uncover a certain amount, and then it makes you wonder a certain amount exponentially more. So I have
Do
to
they
ask
talk
you,
about why there were so many blind children in Little House on the Prairie that they had such a huge house?
No.
Right. Well,
that's the one thing
they
didn't
wouldn't
answer.
Bump into each other. You know, you gotta make a wide berth around people. Otherwise, you know, another fire. You tip over a lantern, Patrick, and we know what happens on Little House. The place goes up.
Oh, yeah. There's no happy endings on Little House.
Yeah. So do you remember, since you started acting at 3, I have to ask you, do you remember the first time you were on a movie or a TV set?
I do. I was actually, it was a movie called The Naked Ape, and I was an extra with my mom. And what I remember was, you know, from an adult point of view, what was happening is they were doing a shot where the car drives down the highway and drives into these big gates, and then something happens, and all these people are by the gates watching the car drive by. As a kid, all I remember is standing around for like 8 hours waiting for this car, and I couldn't understand. It looked to me like the car was doing the right thing. It kept driving into the gate.
That car is an amazing actor. Why do they keep taking it again?
Let me ask you a question. Is Laberteau French or Cajun or anything close to those?
It's a great question. It's Cajun. It was a Laborteau until some Cajun relative got a hold of it and Frenched it up. And I'll tell you, the Parisians are not happy with us.
I don't blame them. Well, they're snooty about everything.
Really? What's their beef?
They're like insulted that they have to say it. You know, it's like,
you know, Do you have relatives in New Orleans or in the...
I do. Yeah, I do. I have Cajun, not Cajun, but I have relatives living in New Orleans and Metairie.
That's a great last name. So you were forced into show business by genetics because you were adopted by a showbiz family. Your dad was a talent agent. Your mom was an actress. Talk about how that was. Did you just assume that you were going to show business?
It's even more diabolical than that. I was adopted, which is great. You know, I love being adopted because you're chosen and there's all these great benefits to it. So as far as the name goes, you know, I'm not Cajun. I'm not French. It's just the name. But I was conceived by two people that came out to Hollywood to be actors.
What?
Yeah. And my mom had done a movie with one of the Coppolas, like one of those independent low budget movies in the 60s. And it was this whole big thing and she couldn't keep the baby. And so, and you know, I'm switching around and jumping.
No,
around
this is interesting.
Timetables, but
sometimes you have to move out to move up.
Yeah. And so they put me up for adoption. I was adopted. And it was, my mom was a comedian with Tommy Dorsey's band.
Really? So when did you learn more about your birth family?
as soon as I could understand it, I mean, they were always explaining it to me. Mm-hmm. So it was never anything like it was a big mystery. The only mystery was like who the people that I was related to were. And later on in life, I found out by, you know, figuring out there's a whole process that goes into it. And it was just, you know, one of the things we did. My dad really wasn't in the business at this time. My dad became an agent years later. At the time, he was an artist. He was a sacred and liturgical artist that created sculptures for churches. Oh, and my mom was an actress, and she'd take us, my brother and I, on her auditions. And we ended up getting an agent and doing commercials. There was a big deal. Commercials were a big deal in the 70s. You could make a lifetime of money in the 70s on commercials. Nationals and things like that.
So what was the first commercial you were in that you remember?
Oh, I did like two Cheerios commercials. I did three McDonald's commercials. I had car ads, Chevrolet, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. That I was in that one.
Yes.
So you were an American boy.
It was a blast. I mean, because basically a commercial is a day or two on a set, and you learn a lot. You learn a lot about how to behave and what to be, you know, what's expected of you. And it was a blast. And the agency I was with was Herb Cannon, and they were really good at having their kids department was really, really fantastic.
Did your brother and you enjoy it equally, or did one of you like it more than the other?
You know, that's a good question. I think we both enjoyed it, but enjoyed it in different ways. There was a period where when I went off to college, I figured, you know, I never really chose to be an actor. And so I stopped acting, I think, for maybe about 2 months. And then I realized, what am I doing? I love acting. I love it. It's just that just because I didn't choose it didn't mean that that isn't where I ended up. And so, but my brother, you know, for a while after Little House, he did a movie or two, and then there's a transition that happens from child actor to adult actor where your product, you, change. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Coke becomes Sprite, and mm-hmm. you can't sell it the same way. Mm-hmm. And so you go up on auditions and you're doing your thing and you're just not getting the same response that you did because you're not the same person anymore. You've grown up. And I think part of that, you know, really affected my brother, and the rejection, which is consistent in this business, if you take it personally, it can really be, you know, it can really affect you. And so he went behind the camera and he does voiceover work now.
Oh, cool.
So it didn't affect you as much. It didn't affect your self-esteem at that point.
I'm a blunt instrument. It just doesn't really matter. And then years later, was producing and I was in casting sessions, you realize that, oh, the actor has no power whatsoever. Mm-hmm. As the producer, when, you know, I've written this script with my wife and we were doing this show with Scott Baio on Nickelodeon, and we were casting all these parts, and people that I had asked to be brought in, friends of mine, they'd come in and they'd do something and I go, oh, no, they're not right. And it was so obvious to me that they weren't right, even though they're great actors. Mm. And so as the actor side of it, you're like, but I gave a great read. It's like, yeah, but it just didn't work. It wasn't the right, you weren't the right person. Mm-hmm. And so once I saw that as an actor, all the ability for me to be intimidated by like the, you know, being turned down for everything doesn't matter to me anymore.
So that's probably something that you teach in your acting classes, right? Is like,
yeah.
It helps you to know that there's 100 reasons why you weren't chosen that have nothing to do with your ability.
Oh, absolutely. Because one of the reasons why working actor school, I started it at all was because I there's another type of acting class, which I call a studio class, where it's in a black box theater. You know, everyone speaks very quietly. They're drinking their tea. They talk about character. You know, they know what Ibsen is. And, you know, they do all of these great pieces of work, but it's not practical. Working on a set, as you guys know, is completely different than doing a scene in front of a class. And so, you know, in a scene, you're coddled and you're talked to and you're taken care of. And on a set, you know, it's like they got 20 minutes left of the light. They're coming around on your coverage. They only have one take left. You got to nail that 20-page monologue that you auditioned with and, you know, and now go and do it. And that's not the same way that, you know, it is in class. Mm-hmm. And so we talk a lot about that. We talk a lot about protecting yourself You know, there's a lot of people that don't know how to protect themselves emotionally from acting. You know, if you're doing it right, you're accessing these emotions that are very, very tender. Mm. If you're actually doing it, then you're exposing yourself to great harm if you don't know how to take it out, use it for the character, and then put it back away for you, and then go home and be yourself. You know, these method actors that, you know, start off the day as the character and continue that for months. I've never heard of a method actor who was a method actor who everyone loved because they were so nice, because they were a method person who was
a
nice.
A nightmare.
It ended up being the method actor. And it's like, they don't send you flowers. They send you dead rats and used condoms. Wow. And it's like, oh, I'm a method actor. It's like, no, you're just being a jerk. Everyone else is going to work. You're kind of doing your own crazy thing. So yeah. I have a feeling about method actors, which we talk about in class.
Let's talk about working at your studio. You operate it yourself. And you have a great website, and there are levels that you can insert yourself into, beginning, middle, and master. Describe the different levels and what you teach in the different levels.
Basically, it's set up with basic, intermediate, and advanced. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what it sounds like. If you're entering into basic, it's someone who's never really done anything in the business, don't know how to break down a script, maybe haven't read a script, don't know what a character is or the point of view. I mean, very, very, without any judgment, I take people who've never wanted or never been doing this, but have an interest in it. I take them from A to B in basic. And then intermediate, you begin to learn how to take those basic skills and grow them to what type of character, how, you know, what's a backstory, where do you get from point A to B in the script, and what's your through line, and what is your, you know, your want in this particular process. And then advanced talks about actual, what's the set like? There is a specific, you know, form of set etiquette. You know, if you've never been on a set, you don't know, you really don't know, oh, I need to be quiet. I've had people have mistakes where, you know, their phones are going off and they're having full-on conversations and they're shooting, and it's like, that's not, there's a lot of rules on a set, basically. Mm-hmm. And so we go through that, and then a basic, intermediate, advanced, and then we have this thing called the acting masterclass, which is after you've gone through all of those things, then that is more of a scene study class, basically, where you're putting together your reel and you have an idea of what type of acting you are participating in and what you enjoy, what kind of characterizations you like, and also to challenge yourself to, you know, broaden your horizons, to make sure that you're able to not really be afraid of anything. There's really nothing to be afraid of in acting. And I think a lot of people are afraid of memorization, or how do I do this, or I can't do that in front of everybody. And there's tricks for everything.
The most intimidating thing about the audition process to me was you go in and read for something comedic and nobody laughs in the audition and your head explodes. Oh, my God, I'm burying this. Can I just leave now and save myself the embarrassment? But that's not what it's about. They never laugh at the funny stuff, which drives me nuts.
No, and it's, I mean, and pilot auditions are the worst for comedic pilots because you've got the network in there and there's a whole, you know, pecking order going on. Where if they laugh, but their boss doesn't laugh, then they're in trouble. And so, yeah, you never hear any laughter. Or, you know, the one I love is that now, you know, we were talking about this before, is that, you know, everyone's doing the self-tape where you have no idea. It's just like, here, mm-hmm. here's an audition. I'm going to shoot into the universe and maybe someone will see it. But back in the day, you know, you'd go in and it's like you've got the camera on you and the casting person's there. And, you know, off camera, you're emoting. I auditioned for, what was it? It was Dexter. I auditioned for Dexter.
Yikes.
And I got the role, but the part was I'm being murdered. And I'm begging for my life from this killer who's murdering me. And I'm crying and I'm sobbing. And from behind the camera in the audition, it's like, take that, no, I'm going to kill you. It's like the kind of acting that you're working with is so horrible that you've got to create everything on your own in your own head.
That's so menacing. Oh. Tell us what was life like for the kids. I mean, as kids growing up watching Little House, we all imagined what it would be like to live on the prairie or to be with you guys on the set, because it was a schoolroom full of kids, and it just looked like the most fun thing ever. So what was it like for the kids on the Little House set, and who got into the most trouble? What all went on with you guys?
Well, first of all, it is absolutely probably the best experience I've ever had in any media at all. I mean, just the Michael Landon ran a set that was kind and friendly and fun. We were shooting for the outside stuff up in Simi Valley when there was no Simi Valley. It was just, you know, it was going to, they hadn't even finished the freeway to get out there. And so it was really, really hot. So the only downside to shooting Little House was during the summer months when we would shoot, because there was no school, it was really hot. And we had people, in fact, Sean Penn, his dad was directing an episode, and Sean Penn was, an extra in one of the scenes, and he just fell over, passed out because of the heat.
You guys almost killed Sean Penn before he could become Sean Penn.
Almost died on the prairie.
That was a close call.
But the actual, all the other kids, like, they were wonderful. They were very, I wasn't on the show until the fourth season. Everyone was very inviting and very welcoming. And we were just a bunch of dumb kids playing in the dirt, like back in the 70s when there was no anything. I mean, we would play backgammon, we'd play cards, we'd draw. Everything was analog. There was no anything to keep your mind busy. And so you just kind of interacted with each other. And that, I think, made for a great set.
So your Little House years were 77 to 81. But thanks to all these interesting platforms like MeTV and Pluto, that these especially shows that resonate with people and activate their nostalgia go on forever. And I think we learned from Allison, there is a very active fan base for Little House, and you guys do meetings and go to Chicago and sign autographs. Are you involved in any of that stuff?
Oh, yeah. I've gone to a bunch of these things, and they're a blast. I mean, it's basically, I had a conversation with Michael Landon once at lunch, and we were sitting there, and I was fascinated. I love Mork and Mindy, and I was telling him all about Mork and Mindy. And he goes, that's a good show. I mean, it's not like Little House. It won't be around for 50 years. And I was a dumb kid. I'm talking to Michael Landon, but Michael was very approachable. And I go, what are you talking about? It's Mork and Mindy. Like, to me, it was the biggest thing in the world. And he goes, yeah, but, you know, with the haircuts and everything, they're going to be gone. But Little House, we're already old. We're going to be on TV forever. And at that point, I didn't get it, because it wasn't a thing. Certainly cable wasn't. Reruns were around, and I got reruns, but I couldn't understand it. And so why these places are so fun to go to is that, yeah, the show's been on since it's been on. I mean, it has never stopped playing. You can watch on every day of the week, you can watch at least 3 hours of Little House. And now they've got channels just that play it constantly. And on top of that, the reason why it's so enduring, I think, is it's a great TV show. But the books are wonderful, and mothers and daughters love the books. Of course, boys and fathers read books too. But it's invariably the mothers, the daughters, the grandmothers that connect up with their daughters. I'm on another show called JAG, which went for a long time. And then I'll get like, oh, I watched that show with my grandpa. Like, grandpa and grandsons and granddaughters will watch JAG, but the grandmas and, you know, daughters will watch Little House. And it's really fun. You know, it's like, look, I'm sure as a weatherman, every day someone recognizes you and go, hey, it's not raining. Or they come up with a joke where they come at you. Like, you know, for some reason that, you know, it's like, hey, man, I do what I do. But with Little House, it's
people ask me, so what's the hardest thing about your job? I would say it's learning to suffer public humiliation gracefully. That's the whole job, right?
Right, but his job was predicting the future. So you get to have a couple of talk days.
Slack. Yeah.
Like for you, what do people say when they talk to you about? I'm sure they start to cry a little bit, right? Because it's
the point of the reference is that with Little House, there's not, I don't have internet trolls coming after me for Little House. You know, it's grandma's going, I love the show. I loved your show. I loved your dad. I love this. I love that. And it's been a really, really wonderful reaction for my entire amount of experience from Little House on.
Plus, it was 1870s Minnesota. And the beauty of that show to me is that family dynamics really don't change over time. A kid's relationship to their brother or sister and the parent's relationship to the kid, it's just in a different social setting at a different era in history, but it really is very much the same. People relate to it.
Very much so, and so much so that Michael understood that he was telling stories of his own life. You know, when he was getting divorced, my parents got divorced. When there was racism rampant, he would tell a story about racism. I mean, it was like he understood even in the 70s that, yeah, it's basic morals stay the same. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, abide by the golden rule. Be good to other people.
Right. There's a parallel in every time period. And I love that you told us about that conversation with Michael. He understood the timelessness of doing a period piece. And you were still in the middle of right now is forever, you know, which is how kids feel. What could be more important than Mork and Mindy? what's possible?
Right?
And now you see it and you got to be in it. And that's really, really, that's fascinating. So you went from Mean Girl Nelly to the Heathers. What did Nelly, how did Nelly prepare you to face the Heathers?
Well, I think what it showed is, you know, the villains are always the most memorable on some level. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about Heathers was it was a black, dark comedy that when you read the script, it was like, I can't believe they just did that. And then when we ended up finishing the movie, it was a pretty great approximation of what everyone saw in the script. So if the movie never became what it's become, we would have all been happy with, like, this is exactly what we thought it was going to be. This really, you know, sharp criticism of all these different aspects of, you know, teenage life at the time, which again is transcendent. You know, mm-hmm. You've got Little House, or not Little House, but you have Heathers. And then the writer of Heathers, his brother directed a movie called Mean Girls, which is like Heathers. And there's a whole bunch of these types of movies anymore that are basically not a ripoff, but like a riff on
an homage.
An homage. And, you know, it's like what I loved about the movie is that it was successful in doing exactly what, you know, Daniel Waters, the writer, had written out in the script. It was, I just loved the script and fought really hard to be in it.
Yeah. And the current manifestation of Mean Girls is in its third iteration. You know, they had a movie, then they had the Broadway, now they have their second movie. Unbelievable. That theme is really kind of eternal.
Yeah, and say the same with Heathers itself. Heathers had a Broadway show, then they had another TV show, which, you know, in my opinion, they missed the end. They didn't understand what Heathers was about. And, you know, Winona loves the project and would love to do another one, from what I understand. And I think, great, I mean, if you get the right people, if you get the same people, because there's so much to be said. But I always loved it because what she had talked to Meryl Streep and tried to convince Meryl Streep to be in Heathers 2, where they would be in Washington and the Heathers would be some senators and representatives. And, you know, this was like 10, 12 years ago. And now it's so obvious that, oh, my God, it's literally what's happening.
Yeah, that will be a documentary at this point.
There was a Heather in the middle of the State of the Union last night.
There was. Oh there she was. Oh, my God.
I wish you would have called her out for the hat. You just have lowered the esteem of this whole thing. Take the hat off and thank you very much.
It felt like he knew when to go high and when to punch in the face.
You know, you talked about, and it sounds to me like you got a lot of interesting wisdom and life lessons from working with Mr. Landon. And in 1992, you and your brother, Matthew, started Youth Rescue Fund. And this was dedicated to helping runways. It's RuPaul's Runway has a whole different charity.
We need these runways for these
poor starting models. I know. I'm sorry.
Yes, we saw that.
You know, for runaways. And you raised over $5 million for shelters all around the United States. And you even testified before Congress. How old were you when this happened?
We were about, I think it was 13 or 14.
Wow.
And it all came about, as you know, when you have any type of notoriety, you're pinged by all these people that want you to participate in an event here or in an event there.
Yeah.
And my parents and management thought that it might be better use of our energies and our appearances if we focused on something that was, you know, geared for young people. And so the Youth Rescue Fund was born, which was just basically what you explained, which is we would raise money with different events to try to get to runaway shelters and runaway outreach programs. And in order to do that, we ended up speaking in front of one of the House subcommittees. And I don't know where the $5 million came from, but I know in that area, we got another $12 million unlocked for a nationwide program for runaway centers.
This might be old Wikipedia data. I don't know.
No, I'm sure.
But it's pretty impressive. All that to say, the fact that you two guys did that early in your life must have been a very satisfying and a great victory for you all to do that. Does it continue today?
It absolutely felt good to help kids.
Yeah. Does it continue today? Does the organization continue today?
No, that was folded up sometime in the 90s when apparently there was the way the machinations of how the money was delivered just became, it was easier to do it in a different form. So we dissolved the nonprofit.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, for sure. I want to talk for a moment about your TikTok channel because it feels like you are watching a good friend tell you a great story. Whose idea was it for you to get yourself on TikTok?
It was a friend of mine and she said, you know, you should go on TikTok. And I go, I don't dance. She goes, no. You can advertise the school by putting up your, you know, some lectures that you would have. And so I tried that. I put up a couple of lectures from some of the classes. And, you know, at the time it was sort of everything needed to be under a minute on TikTok. It was a very specific type of thing. And it just wasn't working as far as like getting any type of good information out there. And then while I was in the beginning part of this and understanding this, they opened it up to over a minute. And then once that started happening, I would tell I would give the whole lecture. And in one of my lectures, I was talking about Carol Burnett, who I'd worked with on a show called Eunice. And out of nowhere, this thing went to like 300, 400,000 views.
Oh, wow.
And obviously I found out, oh, okay, well, if they're interested in stories about this, then I can get my information out by telling stories of what it's like to be, like we discussed earlier, what it's really like to be on a working actor's set. Like, what is it? What are the things that no one really tells you or what it looks like? I just did one on Love Boat, and I had all these different pieces of information, but the number one thing that people kept commenting on was, wait a minute, Love Boat was shot inside? It's like,
wow.
For us in the business, that seems so obvious, but for the people that enjoy the show, it's not something they thought of. And so it's kind of fun for me to tell these stories that, you know, are, you know, experiences that I've had, but at the same time, let people know what it's like behind the scenes. Mm.
And when I'm watching these stories, and you're very charming on camera, I thought, this is another thing that could be taught to aspiring actors or performers, is how to present yourself on social media. Don't just make the dancing video, but you come off, I mean, you're a great salesman for your own personality and everything by doing these warm stories. And I thought that's a great tool for actors to learn in getting their vision out around town. And then I want you to tell the story about your mom and Stan Lee, which is hysterical.
I love that story. It was, so my brother was shooting a movie for Dino De Laurentiis called King of the Gypsies, which was, he played young Eric Roberts. And Dino's, you know, known to be kind of like a big Italian personality. And his daughter, Raffaella, was producing the movie. And they were kind of all over the place. So my brother was kind of like a cover set. So while they were dealing with all these big, you know, Brooke Shields was in the movie and everything, my brother was in New York and he was sitting there for like 6 months doing nothing. And so I came out to visit my brother and my mom. And when we were in New York, I knew that Marvel Comics was in New York. And I love Marvel Comics. I mean, in those doors back there is a full comic book collection. And so when my mom says, hey, what do you guys want to do? I said, I want to go meet Stan Lee at Marvel Comics. And not really understanding how difficult, you know, that is. And at the time, Stan Lee was not Stan Lee. Like, he was huge in the comic book industry, but like the normal person really wouldn't know who Stan Lee is like they know now. So in the comic books, there's the address of where Marvel Comics is. So we went down there thinking, oh, we'll just, you know, say, hey, we're here. Can we come up and meet Stan Lee? Well, it didn't really work out like that because, you know, it's like still it's a business and we're just a random mom and her two kids down in the lobby going, can we come meet Stan Lee, the boss of Marvel Comics? And then I had my comics with me, and my mom saw that on the back of a comic book that I had was an ad for this movie called Orca, which was a Dino De Laurentiis production. Now, this ad had been on these comic books for like a year. Every comic book I bought for like a year and a half was advertising this movie, Orca. Orca, Orca, Orca. Dino De Laurentiis presents Orca. And my mom saw that and went, oh, this is a big, big, big advertiser for Marvel Comics. So then she called back and she says, hi, I'm calling from Dino De Laurentiis' office, and I have two actors here who would love to meet Mr. Stan. She said Mr. Stanley. She didn't really know those two words. And so, sure enough, those were the magic words because it was this huge advertiser, you know. And so, boom, we went upstairs, and sure enough, in the lobby was Stan Lee waiting for us to give us this, you know, tour of Marvel Comics. And he set me up with this art lesson with this amazing artist by the name of Neil Adams, who is a legend in comics. But at the time it was like, here, go to this place and he'll teach you how to draw. And I walk in and it's Neil Adams. It's like walking into Michelangelo's studio and going, are you kidding me? And it was a huge production, a huge experience for us. Obviously, I haven't forgotten anything about
it. I loved your mother after I read that story. I just thought that was the coolest thing ever.
She really knew how to, you know, get, you know, get what she needed to get done for her kids. Mm-hmm. And she was always a great advocate, too. That was probably one of the things that made our experience in, you know, showbiz. We were very insulated. And at the time, I was just like, you know, can I go, you know, where everyone else is going? She goes, nope, not safe. And sure enough, here we are. We're safe.
I love that. That's wonderful. Are you ready to play a game we call IMDb Roulette? Now, your TikTok channel is basically a version of IMDb Roulette, but it's something we do with our guests. And so if you're willing, you may have already told some of these stories, but I'm going to name an IMDb credit, and then you're going to tell us, to the best of your ability, who you played and what that experience was like.
Oh, okay.
Are we good? Okay. So, Blazing Saddles.
This is a great story. Okay. I loved Blazing Saddles. So, they're auditioning for Blazing Saddles. My brother had a snake. My brother loves exotic animals. He's got a parrot now that he's had for 50 years. And he had a snake at the time. And I get this call that they're auditioning for kids for this movie, Blazing Saddles. At the time, it was called Black Bart. And we go to Warner Brothers, and I'm going to meet with Mel Brooks and my mom again. Knowing who Mel Brooks was, thought that it would be hysterical if I brought the snake. So I bring the snake to the audition. In the scenes that I was reading, the kid had a pet snake. So it was kind of like,
oh, there we go.
Perfect. And so I auditioned for Mel Brooks. He just is the most wonderful guy. He hires me, and then I'm on the set for like a month while they're shooting Blazing Saddles, and I have three big scenes. And all of them have been cut out, but it's like, because it's Blazing Saddles, they had 1,000 other great scenes. But my scenes I thought were pretty funny. One was when they come into town, raping and a pillaging, as they say in the movie. They come across this kid with a snake. The bad guy takes the snake, ties it in a knot, gives it back to me. And I look at him and I go, what have they done to you, pal? So that was just one scene.
Like,
and then the other
respond.
Two scenes, which I really wish they'd kept in the movie, was when they're in the church and they're looking for a sheriff, and you've got all these big people, you know, standing up like going, what are we going to do? There's John Hillerman and all these wonderful actors. And in the scene, I raise my hand, and I'm about 6 and I was short, and I raise my hand. I go, I'll be sheriff. And everyone stops and looks at me and goes, whoa, what a brave young man. Yeah, let's make him sheriff. Everybody, let's take a vote. And they made me sheriff, right? And then my mom stands up and he goes, he can't be sheriff. He's 7 years old and he's got school in the morning. And then she sits me back down. And then the scene picks up, and that's where Herbert Lom, the priest, goes, well, we're still going to need a sheriff. And so that was in that scene. And then my favorite scene.
That would have been really funny. I'm sorry they didn't leave that in the movie.
I think so, too. But again, you know, you've got so much good. Every scene is a winner in this movie. Mm-hmm. And they had this one last scene where on the big walkthrough where Cleavon Little's walking down the street and, you know, getting called horrible names and being really abused. He comes across a bunch of kids beating up on a little kid, and they're beating up on me. And so he shoos them all away. He goes, "Hey, stop it." And he brings me up and I'm all bloodied and I've got dirt on my face. And they go, "Oh, what's going on here?" And I go, "We're just playing." And he goes, "What kind of game are you playing?" I go, "We're playing Welcome the New Sheriff."
Oh, no.
And so I had those scenes. There's only one scene when he first comes into town and he stands up on the big, you know, dais, and then the sign sucks itself back up and rolls itself back in, where there's a little kid with a big hat, and that's me. That's the only shot that you can see me in. But I was there for a month, and I loved it because as an actor, you know, when they put makeup on, and back in the day it was this really heavy makeup, you had to always be careful of your collar. But we were in the dirt and we were playing in the Warner Brothers backlot, Western Street. I didn't have to worry about any of that. And then anytime I would act, anytime I would do a scene, I didn't get this at first, but Mel Brooks, I didn't get it at all until I was older. Mel Brooks would go nuts and run up and down the street going, "Oh, this kid's going to be a star. This kid's going to be a star." And I'm like thinking, oh, he really likes what I'm doing. Not realizing that Mel Brooks was doing, you know, a big bit. And then like side story, which I can tell here, I don't really bother telling on TikTok, is obviously Mel Brooks wrote for Sid Caesar on your show of shows. Mm-hmm. And Carl Reiner is like his best friend. Mm-hmm. Well, I got a chance, obviously, to work with Carl Reiner in Summer School, who directed it. And I also, when I did my McDonald's commercials, the person who was directing those McDonald's commercials was a guy by the name of Howard Morris, who was also on mm-hmm. your show of shows.
Yeah.
And so I've collected, you know, just, you know, for those who know what your show of shows is, to me, it's like, I can't get over that I've worked with that many.
Mel Brooks, Neil Simon, Woody Allen, to just name a few.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great story too. We're shooting Summer School and we're on the beach, and me and my buddy Dean Cameron, who played Chainsaw in the movie, we're sitting there telling stories about other actors that we were, you know, going up against. They're like, "Oh yeah, I can't believe Doug got this part." And Carl Reiner comes over, and you know how when someone walks over and they're kind of listening to your conversation, but they don't really join in, they just are sort of listening. And so we're talking and he's listening, and at the appropriate point, he wanted to share a story of his. And he goes, "I remember we were working on a scene and we couldn't get it until we came back from lunch. And it was me, Woody, Mel, Neil." And he just listed off this murderer's row of writers.
The Mount Rushmore.
Finally, we figured it out. And I go, "Man, we got to get new friends."
He was a lovely man, too.
All right. Well, let's move on. The game is really accelerating. MAME, Lucille Ball. And you're MAME, like the son of a son. You're the son of the nephew. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. I play the grandnephew, Peter. And unlike Blazing Saddles, which I shot the very same year as I did Blazing Saddles, it was a big year at Warner's for me. I did this movie. And in every scene of the movie that I'm in, I'm literally physically next to Lucille Ball.
Wow.
So all of it, I got to keep. They kept everything that I did in it. And I had a blast with her. She was a real sweet lady. I couldn't understand, you know, why her voice was always so rough. It was, you know, she was really sweet to me. And I would talk to her about I Love Lucy episodes that I would watch the night before.
Oh, wow.
Without any real understanding that they weren't on the night before. And she would talk to me in the same mode. So like I would say, "How did you do the thing with the grapes?" You know, and she would explain it. And I go, "Did you eat all that candy?" And she would explain it. And, you know, and I had asked her once, I said, "Where's Ricky?" And he goes, "Ricky's not around anymore."
I stepped on him like a grape. All right. This is a good one. This one just made me smile. Young Joe, : the forgotten Kennedy, you play Teddy Kennedy.
That's right. I played Teddy Kennedy in this show. It was back in the day, they did these things called like a mini series, but like a book. And like, mm-hmm. and there was like, you know, this one starred Peter Strauss as the eldest Kennedy son, Joe Kennedy Jr., mm-hmm. who's going to be the, you know, the scion of the family, but he dies in the war. And so I play his younger brother, Teddy, and we went up to Seattle to shoot that. And it was a wonderful shoot. I like the movie. I'm still in the movie. I've got a couple scenes you can pull up on, you know, YouTube even. But what I remember about it was I was really, from a very early age, because of, you know, wanting to be in the business, I always wrote scripts. And I was writing a script called, The Hardy Boys was on TV, and I was a big fan. So I was writing a script called The Would-Be Detectives. And a part of the scene took place at Circus Circus in Las Vegas, and I'm writing it out on my pad. And Peter Strauss comes over, and he goes, "What's Kirkus Kirkus?" And so I still need to spell better than then, but, you know. But it was great fun.
Did you have any, was there any pressure on you? I mean, the Kennedy families were not only legendary, but Teddy was still alive at that point. How is that when you act a character that's there and could be judging your performance and that kind of thing?
You know, it was weird back then. It always felt like it was so far away. Like, we were doing a TV show in Seattle, mm-hmm. and it just didn't feel like it was kind of like as hot button as everything is now.
As to the casting... Patrick, if I may say, you do not look unlike an adult Teddy Kennedy.
Well, that's probably why I got the show, because they had all these pictures mm-hmm. of the Kennedy family. There's one big family photo that they recreated for the show. And I think they cast off of that, of like what people looked like.
You could play him in a movie about his Senate years today.
Now, that would be a hot button topic, because this was long before any of his adventures, mm-hmm. as we will say later on.
So there's a film with the two Coreys, which I want to hear about. It's called Last Resort.
Yeah, there's never been a better titled film.
Now, we have your mom protecting you and Matthew. And then we have the two Coreys, who I'm assuming did not have protective mothers.
I don't know anything about their family situation, but truly, I mean, from what I've heard, from things I've heard from Corey, tragic experiences for both of them. But for me, with that movie, that started off when I was telling you earlier, Fritz, about the ski school movie where we did a little homage to your show. We called it It's Fitz. And in that movie, we're shooting up in Whistler, BC, and we're on a ski slope. It was really cold, and I say, why don't we just forget this movie, do a movie called Scuba School and go to the Bahamas? And I said that to the director, and his eyes lit up, and he goes, "Oh yeah, oh, do you have that movie?" And I go, "Yeah, I got it in my hotel room." And so that night, I went back and I wrote up the treatment for a movie called Scuba School.
Wow,
just a teen comedy in the Bahamas. And so that's where it started. And then it rolls on as this movie that then became a National Lampoon movie. It became National Lampoon's Last Resort. And I was going to star in it with my brother. And then they got a call. I got a call and it said, "Hey, great news. We've got Corey Haim to play, you know, the part that your brother's playing." And I'm like, "But my brother." And they go, "Yeah, but Corey Haim's a huge star right now. And there's video and everything is going to go and we can get more money for it and blah, blah, blah." And I really didn't have any power not to allow that. And so now Corey Haim's playing my brother. And then about 2 weeks later, I get a call saying, "Great news. We've got Corey Feldman." I go, "No, you got Corey Haim." And they go, no, "We've got Corey Feldman and Corey Haim. We've got the two Coreys. This is a two Corey movie, dude." And I'm like, okay.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So now I've written this movie that's this two Corey movie where, you know, Corey Feldman, God bless him, everything has to be Michael Jackson oriented. So he's got this Michael Jackson outfit on. They rewrote the script. I mean, it was a classic, like, I can't believe that this is how, you know, I started off with A. Not that it was anything other than, you know, a teenage comedy. But by the time they finished it, it was just completely different.
The Coreys took the wheel. All right, here's our last entry. And this may be the best. The name of the movie is Attack of the Meth Gator. And the slug line is, when an alligator eats a load of drugs, all hell breaks loose in Florida. You play Mayor Jensen, and I want to know how you address this situation.
The precursor to Cocaine Bear. There it is.
Well, Attack it's the answer to Cocaine Bear for sure. And I think that it is. I have these friends that have a company called The Asylum, and The Asylum does these wonderfully, wonderfully low-budget movies that are a lot of fun, and this is one of them. And I think the best thing about Attack of the Meth Gator is the title, and it says it all. It really does. There's really not much to delve into other than, you know, I had a great time doing it, and I love the people I did it with. In fact, what's really weird is I found out, you know, how you shoot a movie where sometimes you're not, you don't get introduced to the whole cast. I found out that one of the guys playing the drug dealer who gets his meth eaten by this gator, because that's the whole plot, is Robbie Rist, who is a child actor with me. And I have known him since we were like 8 years old. And we've never worked together. Still haven't worked together, but we're in the same movie.
Oh, cool, cool. Well, I think you really aced this IMDb roulette because, you know, you must have to go through your IMDb to come up with the stories for your TikTok, correct?
Yeah, that it's getting to that because you forget type of things that go through your, when you're going through things, you forget it. Like where I just did an episode. I just did something for TikTok called The DeLuise Connection, where it's about my connection to all the DeLuise guys. And it didn't ever occur to me until I'm going through my IMDb. Oh, I've worked with like 3 out of 4 DeLuises.
And 2 out of 2 Corys, yeah.
Deloy.
Hey, I need you to reflect back on one before we wrap up, and that is Miss Edie, the vocal coach.
So yeah, Miss Edie was this opera singing opera teacher, and Miss Edie was the opera teacher of rock stars, where everybody on the Sunset Strip during like the big Sunset Strip era would be sent to Miss Edie by their, you know, by their management, and you'd go in and you'd sing with Miss Edie, and she'd teach you all about, you know, singing from the diaphragm and like, oh, and we'd do scales and everything. But all around her room was pictures of Wasp and these heavy metal bands and, you know, just all in leather. And it was the funniest thing because these guys needed to sing, you know, in the very highest vocal range. And my managers wanted me to like kind of have a pop career like a Leif Garrett or Sean Cassidy. So they sent me to Miss Edie. And as I say in the video, Miss Edie was really handsy. She really wanted you to, she really was intent on showing you exactly where your diaphragm was.
Sure.
And when you're singing, it's like, you know, her hands are right there and telling you exactly where it's going. And, you know, Miss Edie was older. And so, you know, her hands would wander. And at the time, it just became like more of a joke because I wasn't intimidated. I wasn't, you know, offended. But it was just sort of like this old lady who was like, hands all over you. And I would laugh with the guy who would have class before me. I'd ask him, I say, hey, you know, how's Miss Edie today? And he'd go, hey, she's pretty handsy. And that guy ended up, you know, he had a rock band and he kept inviting me to go see his rock band. And I would be there and I'd be able to listen to class, his, you know, his lesson. And he was horrible. I mean, I was great, but he was horrible. And so he would come out and he'd go, hey, man, come see my rock band. I'm like, yeah, totally. And I had never any intention of seeing his rock band because he wasn't that great. And then they turned into be Motley Crue, and this was Vince Neil. And so, you know, later on as an adult, I'm shilling out $1,200 for the Hollywood Bowl to see Motley Crue when I could have gone and seen them.
Well, I guess the lesson finally kicked in, or maybe she hit the right organ.
And he hit the right note.
Yeah, and he hit the right note. So, wow. Patrick, before we close, since you are a qualified instructor, how about if you give a lesson in, if folks wanted to have their own TikTok, or if they already have their own TikTok, what are your tips for making a TikTok, lighting yourself, how to place the camera, what are some flattering angles, how to learn how to talk as if it's a conversation? You know, give us a lesson.
You know, first and foremost, do not put your head in front of a window. So many people have their window behind them and it blows everything out. Put your camera at an angle that's higher so you're looking up. And when you're addressing the camera, just look right in the camera and talk like you're talking to your best friend. And for my particular, you know, like formula of what I'm doing, I am talking to a friend of mine. I'm telling this friend this story that, you know, they hadn't heard. And, you know, for each type of acting that you're going to do, you need to know your intention. You need to know your destination, meaning like, what is, why are you talking at all? Why are you here? Why are you expressing yourself in a scene with, you know, another character? You need to understand what it is that you're after. And in TikTok, you got to know, are you doing recipes? Are you being informative? Are you being telling a story? Are you trying to be funny? As long as you know what it is that you're doing, then all of your other things like lighting and where you're looking and how you're doing it and what you're telling has to be filtered by that very idea. So is telling funny, surprising stories about the industry with a bit of inside information. So each time I think about it, that's what I try to get into it. I don't write the stories. I tell the stories like I'm telling when, like you and I are talking. And then I go in later and then I edit all the stuff that doesn't work, all the stuff that doesn't fit. Now and you, so you get a very naturalistic quality.
It really is. And you've learned a lot about editing because I watched the progression. Now you're including clips and stills. And so what editing software do you recommend people master in order to enhance what it is they're presenting on TikTok?
I use an app called Resolve. Mm-hmm. And it's a big, you have to use a real live computer. It doesn't work on your phone. But what I love about it is it's a incredibly powerful editing suite, and it's free. You don't have to pay for it. It gives great quality. It allows you to do a lot of things. And the thing I love most about it is, let's say I want to do something, but I have no idea of how to do it. I go to YouTube and I go, how do you make a red circle around something in Resolve? Oh. And then there's 1,000 videos that teach you exactly how to do it.
God
so
bless
like
all
the
of
learning
our...
curve is really fast.
God bless all of our YouTube instructors.
Right?
Because we're all at YouTube school. Yeah.
You do a lot of content. How often do you upload something new onto TikTok?
I try to upload a new story every day and then a repurposed story from about 4 to 5 months ago, because everyone coming in and watching my channel isn't, I'm not assuming they've been there and seen everything. Mm-hmm. And so I try to have at least 2 videos a day up.
Pretty amazing.
And how do you interact with comments? Are most of your comments positive? Do you try to respond to everybody?
I try to respond to everybody. And like, I'm usually capable of doing that, but I just put up I told a story about Ray Bolger. And Ray Bolger, the video went, in 3 days, it went past 1 million views.
I want to hear what happened with Ray Bolger.
That, it just sort of was not possible to respond to everybody. But on the regular, I try to at least read everything.
So do you stop and think like, okay, what is it about this Ray Bolger story? Is it just the hashtag Ray Bolger, or what was it about the story that folks responded to?
Well, I think it was because it was a really good story, not because I told it any different than the others, but the story itself is really good, and it lends itself to a really big surprise and a very satisfying ending where it's like, I can't believe that this happened. It's one of my favorite stories. And not to tease anyone, the basic idea is we were shooting Little House. He was a guest on Little House.
Wow.
And so we were hanging out and we were shooting at MGM on stage 15, which is like their biggest stage. And we had moved there from Paramount. And so he comes and he knocks on our door at school and he says, hey, can I take the kids on a field trip? And they had just removed this big oil heater in the corner of the stage where we were shooting. And he takes us over there and he points on the floor and they had uncovered the yellow brick road. For Wizard of Oz.
Stop.
Yeah.
Did you follow it?
It was just an 8x10 piece where the oil thing was. And it was, they put that oil heater right on the yellow brick road back in the 40s or whenever they, you know, I think 37 or 39 when they shot it. And so here we are, Ray Bolger, the Scarecrow, is showing us, first of all, when you're a kid in the 70s, that's the other aspect that is kind of unique, where it's 2020 now. I'm close to 60 years old. When I was a kid, Ray Bolger was like 70 years old. So now it's going back to 1939. You know, those type of stories can't happen really anymore just because mm-hmm. of the age of everyone.
Right. Wow. So as a child, I mean, entering acting as a child gave you access to co-stars from the golden era of Hollywood. And who else did you meet that was starring in movies?
I got to work with Joan Blondell.
Whoa.
I mean, just a blast. I mean, just all these great people that were amazing. I had, Ralph Bellamy Wow. I mean, just these amazing people from these wonderful films that no longer are around, because you can't be 120. And it was because of the opportunities that I had as a young actor that just, you know, being just having the ability to be around. I mean, look at Mel Brooks. He's 99 or something. He's great. But it's like that, those type of folks, you know, when you're a kid, or were in their prime.
Well, do you ever hear from Carol Burnett or someone that you've told a story about? Does it come across, you know, her transit that this is being discussed on TikTok?
Not the older generation. I haven't heard anything from Carol or Mel or anyone, but I did tell a story of a friend of mine who was a star of Back to the Future, Claudia Wells, who played Marty's girlfriend. And I told the story as I remembered it, and I put it up, and it was this big hit. And I get a call from Claudia going, "That's not how it went." And then I had Claudia on the TikTok to say, "Well, because you know it's my memory, so it's like that's always fallible. So tell me exactly how it went down." And she did, and it was really fun.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. Well, it's really engaging. I recommend, if you don't have TikTok, get it right now before they outlaw it, because that's Steve Scalise's plan in Congress. And because Patrick has, and just start on Patrick and make your way through all his videos, and it's just completely delightful.
Really entertaining.
We're so happy that you...
The channel name is not my name. It's Under the School, because it started off as that. So it's Working Actors School. And you can also find the school at workingactorsschool.com or reach out at workingactorsschool@gmail.com.
Yes. And once you, TikTok's really wise. And so once you follow Patrick, it will serve you up with, just on your For You page, it will serve you up. I see every day that I scroll, I see one of your videos. So TikTok knows that I like to look at your videos.
Oh, cool.
We want to thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else that folks should know before we wrap things up here?
No, I think you guys do a great job, and thanks for having me.
Why, thank you. And maybe you'll come into the studio next time with...
Hopefully, yeah, that would be great. The scheduling is on my part was poor, so thanks for the invitation.
Well, you're always welcome, especially since you're a neighbor. Here come your closing credits. Thank you so much for joining us. We would love to continue this conversation with you on Instagram and Twitter, where we are at MediaPathPod, and on Facebook, where our show page is MediaPathPodcast, and our Facebook group is MediaPath with Fritz and Wheezy Podcast Community. I have a TikTok. It's Louise Palanker, where there's clips from the show and other fun content. You can find full video podcast episodes loaded with bonus visual content on our YouTube channel, which is at MediaPathPodcast. We would love it if you would judge our appearance and then subscribe. You can write us at mediapathpodcast@gmail.com, and we want to know about your media path. What have you been watching, listening, and reading? If you enjoy the show, please give us a nice rating wherever you get your podcasts, and share our social media posts so that your friends can learn about your excellent taste in podcasts. Our website is mediapathpodcast.com, and it's a great place to browse around, find interesting episodes you may have missed. We also have a fun and sassy newsletter loaded with photos and quizzes and more dish about our guests. All the newsletters are right there for you to enjoy on our website, and you can sign up to get your newsletter sent directly into your inbox, just one per week. We understand healthy boundaries. We want to thank our wonderful guest, Patrick Laberteau. Our team includes producer Dina Friedman, John Maddox, Bill Filippiak, Mason Brown, Garrett Arch, Jordan Reyes, and you. Our theme music is by me and John Maddox. I am Louise Planker, here with Fritz Coleman and Patrick Laberteau. Be well and wise, and we will see you along the media path.
That was awesome. Patrick, thank you so much.
So really hang for just a moment. We're going to pose in front of the monitor so we can get our picture with you.